I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. The opioid epidemic running rampant this summer has a 30-year backstory and a grisly punchline for 2017. Drug deaths this year alone are heading toward the U.S. death toll in Vietnam over 10 years. The damage has proportions of a plague or a war that will stamp a generation. Let it grow at this rate, and in 10 years, it'll be taking more American lives than AIDS at its peak, then breast cancer, then World War II, then the U.S. Civil War. There's a palpable near panic at what can look like collective mass suicide. There is torpor, too, a post-war feeling after the drugs won. There's dismay about a marketized industry and man-made drugs that manages somehow to kill its customers and keep growing. And so our crash course begins this week to get the size and shape and hear the sound of a full-blown public health nightmare in a circle of purgatory or possibly hell known as the opioid epidemic. Jesse Gaeta is the medical doctor that addicts meet at Boston Healthcare for the Homeless, opposite the Boston Medical Center on Albany Street. Her patients, she says, are the downstream end of the opioid crisis, sometimes literally collapsing from overdoses or in horrible fear of withdrawal. Dr. Gaeta walked us around the main drag of the opioid crisis in Massachusetts. She calls it Recovery Road. It's better known as Methadone Mile.
Sometimes we respond to overdoses right out here on the front walk that are really significant overdoses. It's a place where lots of folks have been actually sleeping at nighttime, and there are moments where it almost feels like an open-air drug market.
Yo, Jamal, you for real?
I don't know if you noticed one person smoking cocaine from a crack pipe. It's so hard.
It's an epidemic. You know, this is out of control around here. We need this.
We need more help in here.
I've been homeless 2 months. Due to circumstances, I became homeless and I came out here to Southampton Street.
What's working for you?
Well, I'm not really a heavy drug addict. Technically, I do K2. I like K2. That's what I smoke.
What kind of treatment or help would you want?
I just want housing. So.
And what do we hear from family?
My family is out of the book. They're written out of the book for the time being.
I'm by myself right here. The first years I was doing good. I got a job, nice job. And then I started hanging out with the wrong crowd. And look at what I ended up. With no place, no family. My wife left me and everything because of drugs.
Tell me this, is your story?
I've been using for 10 years. Not 10 years, I'm sorry. My daughter's 9. I didn't get high when I was pregnant. Never touched a drug. I didn't start till she was a year and a half, so.
You've been doing really well, though.
I've been doing 5 months until 2 weeks ago. I relapsed, and then I got into a car accident 2 days ago in my car. I took off. My daughter, I was taking her to school every day, picking her up these past 5 months. Like, I've been a mother. I've been doing so good. And then just 2 weeks ago, I relapsed.
Tell me just how hard it is to live outside right now.
It's gross. I never seen anything like this. I thought I was in a movie when I came out here because I never got high out here. I just got high back, you know what I mean? Like, to myself. I never really. When I came out here 2 days ago, I slept out here. It's just disgusting.
What treatment do you want?
I was on Suboxone for 5 months. I've been doing great. And then 2 weeks ago, I don't know why, what happened. I lost it. I left the house. You know, I just took off. I haven't seen my daughter since.
Are you getting high now?
Yes, I am.
How hard is it to find what you need?
It's extremely hard. Everything's hard. This whole life is hard. It's like a full-time job to get high. It's just, this life is out of control.
Kathleen Friedel is a political historian best known for her book, The Drug Wars in America from 1940 to 1973. They were the gateway, she argues, to our contemporary crisis. Kathleen Friedel, welcome. Once upon a time, you write, we had a pretty effective drug enforcement regime. What happened?
Yeah, our effective drug enforcement regime, including our policing of illicit drugs, was premised on a regulatory model of taxes and tariffs. So we tracked all opioids, including heroin, which was once illicit painkiller, as soon as they came into the country by virtue of a tariff. And then by following them through a tax stamp at every location, we track those drugs, including their diversion. But in the 1940s and in the 1950s, the Bureau of Narcotics and Drugs, which is the predecessor to the Drug Enforcement Agency, landed on this great idea, and great idea there is in quotes, to actually prohibit heroin because there was such a problem with diversion of the drug. And by ever-increasing steps, slowly but surely, we've wound up into a place where drug prohibition now greatly compounds the harms of the drug crisis itself. So drug prohibition has turned what was once a regulated drug and a known risk into an unregulated drug and an unknown risk.
In the 80s, Kathleen, and we remember it, suddenly pain doctors appeared and pain medications galore. And without warning, I mean, without warning of addiction, how did this happen?
Yeah. Well, there are some features of the opioid crisis, you know, the sounds of which you just ran through and which are heartbreaking to hear. There are some features of the current opioid crisis, the worst drug crisis in U.S. history, by the way, that are very typical of other drug crises that we've had in the past, in the sense that, you know, it's been widely acknowledged that they were preceded by kind of the abandonment of government policy from certain communities and certain places, and also the disappearance of work. But there are some things, there are some features to our current opioid crisis that are kind of a failure of politics specific to our current moment. And in particular, there are two things: drug prohibition, which we just ran through, and the second one is global neoliberalism. And that neoliberalism is typically characterized by three things. One is deregulation. The second is austerity, which usually involves the privatization of some government functions. And then the third is unrestrained free trade. Remarkably, all three of those things play a role in the opioid crisis. And in particular, what you were just mentioning, the kind of mass marketing of pain pills, has a lot to do with the transformation of the institutional culture of the Food and Drug Administration as a result of deregulation and privatization.
Kathleen, the most interesting number I've read in a sort of crash course of my own is that 4/5 of new heroin users today are coming off prescription painkillers. Just how does that transition happen?
Okay, so that number came to us in 2013, and it was a huge wake-up call, at least within the community of practitioners. This opioid crisis has unfolded in kind of successive ways, and you can kind of think of it as big pharma laying the foundation for the broad prescribing of opioid pain pills, especially for chronic pain, but for, you know, acute pain prescribing as well. They laid a foundation that was later kind of built upon, if you will, by illicit drug cartels. And so throughout the first 10 years, the first decade of the new century, we saw steadily increasing opioid overdoses, largely as a result of prescription pain pills. Then around 2009, we started to see heroin illicit markets feed off of the very same people and the very same places that were most susceptible to prescription pain pill overdoses.
Mm. How different, Kathleen, is the deregulation of drugs and of pain medicines from the deregulation of banking? Glass-Steagall, that separated speculative banking and service banking, should we say, boring banking.
It's a great comparison in my eyes because a lot of the dangers can't be predicted at the moment of deregulation. There is a danger of unintended consequences that are involved in these kinds of structural reformulations, like the repeal of Glass-Steagall, for instance. Nobody could have predicted the ways in which financial derivative products would destabilize the global economy. Well, likewise, when Bill Clinton thought it was a great idea to modernize the FDA and transition half of its budget over to industry, so the Food and Drug Administration now gets half of its money directly from the government and half of the money, money directly from the pharmaceutical industry. The ways in which, I mean, pain pills and pain pill overprescribing was fairly new at that time. Nobody could have predicted that it would lead to the worst drug crisis in U.S. history, and yet here we are.
Well, again, the worst banking crisis in modern memory, too. I keep wondering why they don't just reenact Glass-Steagall, but I also wonder why the FDA and the industry don't say, oops, bad mistake, we're going to reimpose the old rules.
Yeah, it's actually tremendously disheartening to be active in this space, because we are at a point where in March 2016, the Los Angeles Times published an investigation that disclosed previously sealed court documents. So these court documents came from a West Virginia lawsuit against Purdue Pharma. And those documents made it clear that Purdue Pharma advocated for the approval of OxyContin based upon misleading information, and that the FDA was aware of that and knew of that misleading information. And yet just last week, the National Academy of Sciences released a report on opioid pain pills and the opioid crisis more generally. And I was hoping one of their recommendations would be specifically to reinvestigate the legitimacy of opioid pain pills for prescribing for chronic pain, which is one of the kind of largest markets that we've seen Purdue Pharma really exploit. And they do, in a broad sense, encourage the FDA to review opioids as a class of drugs. But there's a huge reluctance on the part of the political establishment to revisit some of these decisions because people are still making a lot of money from them.
Whoa, but everybody knows somebody whose kid had a football injury, got, you know, a bad steer to a pain pill, and got into deep trouble. I was prescribed OxyContin without my knowing it for a tooth implant. No pain of any consequence. It was completely unnecessary. We all know that these things get way overprescribed. I mean, what would it take to cut through the financial power of that industry?
Well, that's exactly it. I think you put your finger on it, which is a lot of people are under this impression that we can walk ourselves out of the darkest days of the opioid crisis purely via voluntary messages and education.
Kathleen, stand by. We'll be back. Coming up, Whiteout by Michael Clune stands out in the opioid literature for taking readers inside the mind, the experience, the imagination of addicts when they're high or when they're crashing. Addiction is a memory disease, he says, a failed mechanism when it comes to sorting out the past. This is Open Source. The writer Michael Clune was born in Ireland, raised in Chicago with a yen for books. He was studying at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore for his PhD in English when he met the high of heroin and then the black hole that he decided over and over was inescapable. He got out 15 years ago with a qualified reverence for what heroin does. He begins here from his book, Whiteout.
In Baltimore that summer, the best heroin was sold in little glass vials with white stoppers, white tops. The color of the stopper was like a brand. If it was good, its reputation would spread. Where's Dom? Dom's dead. What was he doing? White tops. Who's got white tops? Fathead. Where's Fathead? Eventually, dealers with inferior product would start using the good color, and then the people with the hot dope would have to change to red or blue stoppers. It was a cycle. I've been off the stuff for almost 6 months, but as soon as I saw that empty white top, I got a funny, destiny feeling. You might think that the whiteness of the white tops isn't that important. After all, I'd bought red tops, blue tops, black tops, even yellow tops. Of course, the drug itself is often white, but it can also be brown, and the white is really just an effect of the cut. But the first stuff I ever did was in a vial with a white top, and its whiteness showed me dope's magic secret. The secret is that the power of dope comes from the first time you do it. It's a deep memory disease. People know the first time is important, but mostly they're confused about why. Some think addiction is nostalgia for the first mind-blowing time. They think the addict's problem is wanting something that happened a long time ago to come back. That's not it at all. The addict's problem is that something that happened a long time ago never goes away. To me, the white tops are still as new and as fresh as the first time. It still is the first time of the white tops. There's a deep rip in my memory. What I would say with my experience of addiction, I think the aspect that a lot of people have a difficult time understanding is that it is a memory disease. Now, the actual experience of taking heroin, even the first time, it is euphoric, but it's no more so than a whole variety of other kinds of experiences I've had, ranging from falling in love, walking in a beautiful landscape. But here's the crucial difference, right? For the addict, that experience in your memory grows so large and intense and unforgettable and omnipresent that it dominates you and almost forces you to worship it in a way that those other experiences really don't. There's no other analog to it. So I always want to draw a sharp distinction between the way the addict feels when they take it and the way that the addict remembers it. During my using days, I had a friend named Dave. And Dave was not an addict, but he did heroin with me a couple times. And every time we did heroin, you know, he would say the next morning, hey, that wasn't that great. And I would be saying, what are you talking about? It's the best thing ever. So one time we did an experiment. I got a pen and a pad of paper and we both did heroin together. And I said, Dave, write down on the pad what you're experiencing. And he wrote down, this is the best feeling ever. This is amazing. I feel so relaxed. I feel like I'm floating. The next morning, he said, oh, it was an okay time, but I basically remember it being kind of sleepy and throwing up a bunch of times and that's it. And I showed him the paper and he said, well, that's weird, but I don't really remember it that way. For me, when I think about the heroin or look at any of the objects associated with heroin, whether it's a spoon or a straw or a vial or the white powder, instantly what flashes back as if no time at all had elapsed was the memory of the euphoria of the first time. For me, the first time I did it was on a roof in Soho in New York in the summer. And that's the experience. That roof comes back, the way the sky looked, the people I was with. That's what I see when I look at dope.
We've spent some time just, and you can't avoid it these days in a big city or even in the countryside. You meet all kinds of addicted people. Can you put us in the heads of those people? They're homeless, they're poor, they've got complicatedly screwed up backgrounds and histories.
I can relate and empathize with addicts. And I also, you know, work with on a volunteer basis with addicts here in Ohio today. Anyone who's had the experience of addiction, I think, can relate. On a day-to-day basis, my life was essentially all about getting money, right? And getting the drugs. That becomes your entire life. From the moment I wake up in the morning, I'm hustling. How am I going to get some money? What can I do in terms of bouncing checks? What stores can I steal from? How can I come up with this cash, right? Because the thing is, it's like an hourglass. You've got about 4 to 6 hours from every dose until the withdrawal symptoms start. The best thing that ever happened to me was getting arrested on a felony charge in Chicago on New Year's Eve in 2001. That arrest and putting me in jail and over the next days in jail, I got some of that distance from that rat race, that insanity that made me think, hey, maybe I need to get some more serious help for this.
A woman that sounded like you, Michael, talked to us yesterday, and she said, as you're saying, this is insanity. I'm in a bad movie. This is ridiculous. I got to get out of here, but I've been in it for a long time, that sort of thing. But she's the privileged one. So many more don't seem even aware of where they're at. They're numb. And say it.
I mean, this is the million-dollar question, which is, why was I able to find recovery when so many people that were smarter than me, less addicted than me, that I've known in my life are now dead or serving life sentences in prison because of the things they did in their addiction? I have no idea what the answer to that question is. I went to probably, I think I added it up one time, I went to 13 detoxes in my years of addiction. I went through withdrawal 13 times, went through the worst of it 13 times, the vomiting, the shakes, the chills and so forth, the depression. I was fortunate to get arrested with a serious enough charge to take me off the street for long enough for that moment of clarity to take hold as it finally did. Very, very fortunate. I'm sure I would be dead by now if it wasn't for that. The message I've got to give is you can be happier than you've ever been, more peaceful than you've ever been, not on drugs. Because when you're an addict, you can imagine life without drugs. It just seems to you like this boring, endless, pleasureless expanse, right? This desert. Freedom from that grind, freedom from that depression, that despair, that is a huge, I mean, it's amazing. It's like a high every day for me, to be honest. And then it just opens the door to all the ordinary pleasures of life, right? I remember after I was clean for about a few months, and the depression subsided, the taste of food, the pleasure of walking outside and being in nature, really minor pleasures that ordinary people take for granted, for the addict, comes as a revelation.
Michael Clune is a professor of English at Case Western University in Cleveland, and that's his version of the story. Michael Patrick McDonald has another from his memoir, All Souls, about South Boston in the 1980s and 90s, a proud old Irish-American community coming apart around poverty, crime, drugs, and then gentrification. Michael, I never forget your line that addiction is about trauma, trauma, and trauma. Explain what you mean.
Well, in my experience anyways, with the populations I've worked with, what I've seen over and over is that people that are struggling, especially with any kind of pain-killing addictions, are coming from a life of trauma, basically post-traumatic stress. And the population that I come from in South Boston, for people who don't know, growing up there in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, it was a neighborhood with the highest concentration of white poverty in America, and it was also controlled by organized crime and Whitey Bulger. It was large housing projects, mostly Irish-American community. Mm. And you had a lot of death. You had a lot of trauma. You had a lot of people disappearing. You had murders. You had people getting involved in truck hijackings and bank robberies, people going, you know, being incarcerated. So a lot of families with a lot of trauma and really world-shattering trauma in their lives. Now, during the years that we were controlled by organized crime, Whitey Bulger was confirmed in the trials, the Whitey Bulger trials a couple years ago. During those years, he oversaw the influx of cocaine into the community, and we had the highest death rate from cocaine and crack, higher than any other neighborhood in Boston other than perhaps Charlestown in South Boston. The other small Irish American working class and poor community at the time, we were always competing for highest death rates, but these weren't discussed at all. These weren't in the news. These were kind of our secret because these were things that only I would find in the public health statistics, but nobody talked about these things. And the neighborhood was kind of invisible in terms of people wanting to work on those issues and the issues that might lead to that level of addiction and death. Now, we also had this code of silence, so nobody in the neighborhood talked about it. Media weren't really, you know, getting information if they would come into the community, so it was nobody would speak to the media. Mm. This was the effect of having someone like Whitey Bulger in a tight grip on that stuff. So you come out of those years. Whitey Bulger goes on the lam in the mid-90s. Now, he did – it is true that he kept heroin out of South Boston. That's something that he bragged about in court. And that is true, and we all always knew that. And it was always as if, well, heroin's particularly dirty and there's, you know – but meanwhile, all our deaths that were happening throughout the 80s were pretty much as a result of cocaine and crack. Now, when he went on the lam, that's when you had this community – left behind with immense pain, and then you had an influx of heroin into the community. And we had a huge explosion of heroin deaths in the mid to late 90s, and one that has continued with the diaspora of this neighborhood since then.
I'm remembering, Michael, that your tribute to heroin is that it works. And you quote medical authorities, real ones, who say it may be the only thing that works against post-traumatic distress syndrome. Explain that. And what are the alternatives?
One of the things during the mid to late 90s, there was a huge upsurge in suicides in our neighborhood from hanging. And there was a huge attempts, people being cut down every day. For about 6 months, we had this huge suicide epidemic among teenagers. At the same time, you had the beginning of the heroin epidemic. In both situations, you were dealing with people who had all the experiences I had in my family, coming from a family of 11 and losing four siblings very young to the effects of poverty and violence and incarceration and drugs. So all of the people I saw that were dying in those years were coming from the exact same experiences I come from, with the same levels of trauma. Mm-hmm. Now, the problem was that the city of Boston, the solution that they had for this epidemic was to send in teams of psychiatrists who were giving people prescriptions, for pills. And basically, a good friend of mine's the head psychiatrist at Bellevue, and she always, when she ever gives talks, she's always talking about how there is no pill for post-traumatic stress. There's one thing that quote unquote works, and she's only saying this to account for why people turn to it, and that is heroin. Heroin works. People with post-traumatic stress will have a natural gravitational pull toward heroin. Not to say that everybody on heroin has huge, you know, adverse childhood experiences, but it is true that, you know, statistics show that people with high adverse childhood experiences are way more likely to become addicted long term and to die as a result.
Michael, I want to draw Catherine Vito back. She's talking policy. You and Michael Clune are talking emotional pain. What's the meeting here, Kathleen?
You know, what rings out for me in terms of what Michael just shared with us is the mid-1990s influx of heroin. That's one of the things that jumped out at me when he was talking just now, because the mid-1990s is a time when NAFTA, as a trading agreement, tremendously increased the flow of goods into this country. And I can tell you, it's, you know, most of the time no one mentions it, but nothing, not a single thing has influenced the influx of illicit substances into this country more than the NAFTA agreement. You know, drugs are a trade, and anything that increases the flow of goods and people across borders are going to lead to an influx of illicit drugs. And so I'm not surprised at all with the timing of the first heroin epidemic that hit South Boston.
But are you advocating walls, Kathleen? I mean, shall we stop trade altogether?
No, but I'm not surprised that people are. I think that Trump's kind of ludicrous suggestion was greeted with a kind of, you know, coastal snobism and a kind of dismissing of it. It's important to realize that a lot of the counties from which he drew his votes have been so heavily ravaged by the opioid crisis that they have reason to look at Mexico. Even if they don't have a lot of immigrants living amongst them, they have reason to look at Mexico with a lot of anxiety.
Michael, over to you. I mean, how do you stand on trade?
Yeah, I totally agree that that, you know, neoliberal global capitalism has had a huge part to play in all of this, and it's just a matter, you know, I think that Trump has, you know, kind of tapped into one aspect of this truth and turned it into a xenophobic rage nationally, and that's unfortunate, because there is some aspect to that that we have to address, which has everything to do with globalization. But you know, of course, in his rhetoric, it turns into a racial profiling.
I want to question the branding of this word pain. You've said and written, Kathleen, that there was a move on at some point to make pain the fifth vital sign, along with your blood pressure, your temperature, your respiration. Yeah. The confusion of chronic pain, physical pain, emotional pain, real pain, imagined pain. What about pain, Kathleen? Is it a legitimate reason to be dropping regulation?
No, certainly not. But it is a legitimate medical crisis. In the field of chronic pain, what we have now is chronic medical failure. And remarkably, in the midst of the broad overprescribing of opioid painkillers, we still, in many respects, stand in a health system that actually undertreats and poorly treats pain. I return in again and again to the simple fact that opioid painkillers have not been proven to be clinically useful for chronic pain patients. That is often neglected, and of course, Big Pharma, which sort of owns a lot of real estate in the political and media establishment, wants you to forget it, but we have yet to prove the utility of these drugs. But that's to say nothing of the realities of pain. And a lot of the things that Michael was describing, and another one of the comments he made that jumped out at me, is pain is actually often is accompanied by other ailments, especially kind of depression, PTSD. And I'm not saying that people imagine they feel worse. I'm saying that pain is actually literally worse when you have those conditions. That's how funny our brain is wired. So once again, it's really not surprising to me that when you have communities and neighborhoods exposed to trauma, you know, and what we're seeing in red state and red county America, entire swaths of our country exposed to the disappearance of work, you know, Rust Belt America, so on and so forth, it's really not surprising that we should find a pain crisis where there's been the abandonment of communities.
Hmm.
Right, and I would say that, you know, when...
Michael McDonald, go ahead.
When you have this community in, you know, immense emotional pain and having suffered huge catastrophes that they weren't allowed to talk about, then turning to, for example, the hanging epidemic, around that time, I was speaking out in the paper, talking a lot about the role of trauma in all of this, and it was pretty much being ignored because people just wanted it to go away and they just wanted to put these kids on pills. I bumped into a point person for the city of Boston who became a good friend of mine, a point person working on this stuff, and she said to me, please keep speaking out. Now, I thought she was going to be angry at me for all the stuff I was saying in the paper. She said, please keep speaking out, because every one of those kids that tried to hang himself, we locked up and we put them on pills, and every one of them today is a heroin addict.
Wow. Michael, I want to hear more when we come back about your alternative therapy of talking. Tell the story, find the story, transform the story, make the story, and keep telling it. Coming up, the color line that runs between the crack epidemic in the 80s and opioids today. Media storytelling, law enforcement, lasting consequences are conspicuously different. This is Open Source, a primer on the opioid plague before it engulfs us. How unlike the flood of crack cocaine that hit Black America in the 1980s. That epidemic accelerated the war on drugs, the quasi-military transformation of policing, and 40 years of mass incarceration. I asked Donna Murch, drug war historian at Rutgers, to tear and compare the two crises.
What's really striking to me with the opioid crisis is that it continues, but white users are seen in an entirely different lens. And the article that came out in the New York Times had a picture of a mother and a child, and was talking about the problems of a child born addicted to buprenorphine, which is a drug that's used to help wean people from their opioid addiction. And it was an incredibly empathetic account of mother and child and the challenges they faced. And I think everyone who read that of a certain age immediately thought of the discussion about crack mothers and crack babies and the development of a whole generation of people, essentially, who were not human, who would not have powers of reason, who would be unable to function in society, would be capable of incredible amounts of violence, and the only thing that could be done would be to warehouse them. And that's where you see how purely this was about race and had nothing really to do with questions of addiction, dependence, or public health.
So how would you apply that hindsight? I mean, will we ever go back and look at Black families who are being devastated by crack and say, we've got to make it up? They were in desperate need of income, help, treatment, counsel, housing.
Yes, I think that's very well said. I think thinking about a kind of truth and reconciliation about what happened in the drug war and having that discourse. And I want to be clear, the drug war continues. People are still being arrested and prosecuted, especially for marijuana possession. So stopping what's happening now, it's not only past tense, it is continuing throughout the country. I think what we need to continue to talk about is people that have had inordinate sentences, getting people out of prison, breaking down the line between violent and nonviolent offender. So I think using the racial contrast between the way these two different problems are being treated to really highlight the deep role of structural racism and to think about most urgently how to get people out of prison and make sure they're not being put in prison in the future.
Correct me if I get this wrong, but I mean, what I'm hearing is that the response to crack in the 80s was hyper-policing and mass incarceration. The response to the opioid crisis includes a lot more empathy, not big incarceration of users. It's a disease, not a crime. Is that racism at work, or is it also progress?
You know, it's hard to disentangle the two, but there's no question that it was racism. I mean, the intense racial discourses that were used, like super predator, the language of a people that essentially were not human. You know, it's always you'd have to use a counterfactual. What would be happening now if we imagined that the opioid crisis was primarily African Americans? Given the scale of punishment, the mechanisms for stop and frisk still exist in many places throughout the country. So in that sense, I don't think that it's just been a transformation from one to the other. The media coverage is specifically about white opioid addiction, as it's been called. But that doesn't mean that the whole punishment apparatus still isn't being directed at not only African Americans, but also Latino populations, the undocumented. So maybe we've made some progress. I'm not sure. I think that the status of opioid, because it was linked to prescription drugs, also does matter.
How so?
Well, I think it's part of the class composition of this crisis. You know, it's people that had health insurance. Right? There's the discussion about these are middle and upper middle class people. There is also a discussion about Adderall. But, you know, the drugs that are killing people now are prescription medications.
Donna, make what you can of the Trump politics of all this. We associate the hillbilly counties that voted for Trump with the problem. What is the connection?
You know, it's a very good question. I think it's well into a narrative, you know? The narrative is that this reflects white suffering. And I think that's how it links into the Trump base. So even Republicans who are absolutely hardline stance on the drug war are talking about we need to find monies within the ACA repeal and reset specifically for opiate addiction. That has to do with how they see their base. It's also happening in the context of people with a radical deregulatory regime. That's why they can't talk about pharmaceutical companies. These are big, powerful companies. They're crucial to the American economy. And I think that that's why we're getting a much narrower discussion about the focus on the people themselves, rather than to ask ourselves the core policy questions. How did this happen?
Donna Murch has written a book forthcoming titled Crack in Los Angeles, Policing the Crisis and the War on Drugs. Back to you, Kathleen Friedel, who wrote A History of the Drug Wars and Policy Since the 1940s. What do you make of the racial key to the differences here?
Yeah, I think Donna is completely right that the stereotype of addiction has changed dramatically from the crack cocaine epidemic to the opioid crisis now. And I think she's also right. In fact, you know, the published work of my own agrees with her that racism was a major driver of drug prohibition and all of the kind of subsequent mass incarceration bills that we saw from 1984 to 1990 and 1994. But I do want to raise, you know, I think it's important to draw similarities between and among the various drug crises, and I think it's important to also distinguish them. So the way in which the stereotype of addiction has changed is one contrast. Another is the crack cocaine epidemic inflicted its worst damage in homicide rates, and it inflicted its worst damage in cities among young African-American men. And in fact, the homicide rate among them actually paralleled some of the worst opioid overdose death rates that we've seen in Rust Belt and Steel Mill America. And so it was actually a massacre. But I think people react to homicide very differently. And in particular, I think that there was a lot of support for mass incarceration and punishment policies from the very same African-American communities that the crack epidemic was raging in. So that's one kind of point of distinction. Another thing that I think is worth keeping in mind is, you know, the drug war has not been dismantled. And I think the addiction stereotype has changed, but we still have opioid users who are incarcerated. In fact, a lot of the rhetoric and some of the programs of treatment are coexisting alongside a move towards greater punishment. And that's not just Donald Trump and Jeff Sessions. Across counties and, you know, among and throughout the various states, we're now seeing punishment and mandatory minimum sentences coming back. So I think, you know, to look at it with a historian's eye, it's really too soon to say that we've changed the discourse and we've changed the approach to a public health approach. Yeah.
Michael McDonald,
I was going to totally agree with that. I get alerts on, you know, on heroin and Massachusetts in particular. And so every day you get multiple stories, and most of them are about arrests. And if you pull up the pictures, most of them would be users. And the drug war is on. And again, they would be, at least in Massachusetts, they would be white. And if you know, I come from poverty, and I tend to be able to identify class, and I can usually guess that they come from poverty. And so the other aspect of this that I just wanted to mention is that I did a lot of community organizing. Most of my work over the years has been in, you know, poor and working class Black communities, Latino communities, white communities, and it is true. I agree that the manifestation of the crack epidemic was in shootings, and that's the huge, you know, massacre, as you say, that happened. I totally agree, and we're seeing something that's really on parallel with that. But I also want to say that the perception that this is a white, i.e., rich people problem, or even middle class or upper middle class problem, is a myth that's been out there, because white and suburban tends to mean middle class to people, and that's just not true. Hmm. So, you know, if you look at the CDC reports for heroin use and the Massachusetts reports, if you look at health insurance coverage, it's overwhelmingly people with no health insurance coverage or Medicaid, but also overwhelmingly people who come from households that make $20,000 or less. If you look at Massachusetts, it's overwhelmingly people with a high school education or less. So those are some indicators that would point to the class that's disproportionately impacted. It doesn't mean that we don't all know people from wealthy families who have lost a son or that it's spreading, because all this stuff spreads.
I want to know about the new empathy, the non-judgmental treatment, and the empathy for addicts is striking. But I wonder, how deep does it go between your generation in South Boston, for example, and the families of the Black families of the crack epidemic?
Well, it's
who
true
went
that,
through mass incarceration, still going through it.
Right. It's true that the response to the crack epidemic was totally racist, and it was all about demonization, the super predator, and all that stuff. I was there for all of that, and I remember all of that, and worked with a lot of families, survivors of homicide victims, who were dealing with that. What we dealt with also in South Boston, because I was working in both communities at the same time, but in South Boston, what we were dealing with is just an invisibility. So it just wasn't. So I would say places like South Boston throughout the country, including a lot of the Rust Belt states. And by the way, when you look at the map of, the worst of the opioid epidemic, the Rust Belt states are the worst, along with Massachusetts and Rhode Island, which is really interesting.
Explain that. Massachusetts and Rhode Island on the national map.
If you look at the map, that's what's colored in the darkest for the opioid epidemic. And I would say that a lot of in Massachusetts and Rhode Island, a lot of the class indicators would be more invisible to people. First of all, we're always perceived to be, you know, Harvard and, you know, upper class liberalism and all that kind of stuff, right? So the perceptions are just different from the reality. But we're up there with the Rust Belt states. And I would say that there's a lot of parallels in terms of the disappearance of work and things like that. But what we experienced was more of an erasure. And it's really not I would say, I mean, I hate to say one's worse than the other, but it's not as bad as demonization and super predator and all that kind of stuff. So, but these are different levels. But I think that there's a, you know, people do know their friends who are middle class and upper middle class whose son is addicted, or, you know, and got hooked first on pain pills and it got worse. So everybody knows someone like that. So I think the perception is that it's becoming more affluent white, and therefore you might have more, you know, it's in the press more. But when it was happening to us, and it has, you know, it's an ongoing thing along with the drug war. It's an ongoing thing I've seen over the past 2.5 decades. But when it over the years, we were kind of missing from the story. Now we might be in those stories, but you know, the newspapers will call it white middle class, and white suburban, and that looks middle class to me.
Kathleen, I got two quick questions on fentanyl, which is sort of new to me. One, have we not missed a huge opportunity in the in the dreadful death of Prince, the entertainer, to surface that danger, to do for the fentanyl problem what Rock Hudson did for AIDS?
Yes, we have. And in fact, fentanyl, which illicit fentanyl is largely produced in China and sent either directly to the United States or via Mexico. I don't understand, having said before that, you know, drugs are a trade, I don't understand why the United States government has not raised China's unregulated chemical manufacturing.
I wondered too. But here's my second question about fentanyl in China. What if fentanyl is history's revenge for Britain's opium wars in China in the 1830s and 40s. It was all about forcing Indian opium into China. The Chinese resisted, and the British whacked them and said, no, you're going to take it in the name of free trade.
Exactly. And in so many ways, and what I've tried to underscore in my remarks, is this opioid crisis is a karma boomerang coming back. Right? And it's not just global neoliberalism and unrestrained free trade, which, by the way, I also don't understand why heroin and fentanyl-laced heroin is not a part of the NAFTA renegotiation. It should be. It should be one of the things that's on the table. But what I want to say is that Donna's right about the stereotypes, and I think Michael's right about the erasure. I know he's right about it. But all of this is changing as a result of fentanyl. Fentanyl
right.
will now more broadly distribute it. The harms of heroin across regions. We in Washington, D.C., the place where I live, we've actually seen our opioid overdose deaths double within the past 3 years, and that has actually had its own form of silence. And our response to it has not gotten anywhere near the attention that it should. So, you know, whatever the harms were in the past, and I think it's important to discuss those, everybody's going to be at this table eventually, and I think it's incumbent upon us all now to start to point to the pain that's behind this opioid crisis and the policies that have produced it.
Could I ask you both, before we're done, not that we want to bring any more militarization to our police forces, but are we paying, are the police paying enough attention to the peddling of drugs, including fentanyl, to our kids? I mean, it seems we used to, in the crack time, we had drug free zones around schools and a lot of talk about it. Where has that vigilance gone in the opioid crisis?
Well, you know, I can't speak for Michael, but just quickly for myself here in D.C., one community I don't understand why it's not better protected is methadone clinics. Methadone clinics are a known target of illicit heroin dealers, and now with white powder heroin that's being laced with fentanyl, I don't understand why our police resources, I mean, I do understand it, but I raise this in community meetings to say I don't understand why our police resources, our proactive and protective policing, can't be extended to our most vulnerable and exploited populations.
Michael McDonald.
I agree that absolutely that you know, we're seeing a lot of that with around the methadone clinics in Boston as well. But I want to also say that, you know, we have to be careful, of course, with asking for more law enforcement at the little guy level and more action on the part of the feds. You know, a lot of our problems in South Boston, we had a drug lord that was in cahoots with law enforcement, and so we have to be really we have to be really careful about what we're asking for there. So I think that we could do more on all levels, and certainly in terms of getting people to be able to be aware of the trauma that they come from and to be able to tell the story in a safe way and to be able to transform that into, you know, a lifelong mission to.
Yeah. While we're at it, Michael, we could ask the Drug Enforcement Administration to rethink the licensing of production of this stuff and reinstituting the severe restrictions on what drug companies can produce.
Absolutely. In terms of things growing and spreading, let's remind ourselves what happened with the gun violence epidemic, which was perceived to be isolated in black communities and has become a national epidemic as well.
We got to remind ourselves of the time limits of the hour, too. Thank you, Michael Patrick McDonald. Thank you, Donna Murch, Jesse Gaeta, and the very helpful people at the Boston Healthcare for the Homeless. And to Kathleen Friedel, whose Twitter handle is Kay Friedl, K-F-R-Y-D-L. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Becca DiGregorio, Susan Coyne, and Kevin Doherty. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time, please, for Open Source.